Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. 1 month ago, President Biden was preparing to accept the Democratic Party's nomination. So much has changed since then. Last night, during his speech at the Democratic National Convention in Chicago, he handed over the torch to Vice President Kamala Harris. Like so many speakers, President Biden talked about Israel's ongoing assault on Gaza as protests took place outside and inside the convention hall.
We're working around the clock, my Secretary of State, to prevent a wider war and reunite hostages with their families and surge humanitarian health and food assistance into Gaza now. To end the civilian suffering of the Palestinian people and finally deliver a ceasefire and end this war. Those protesters out in the street, they have a point. A lot of innocent people are being killed on both sides. Just as we worked around the clock to bring home wrongfully detained Americans and others from Russia in one of the most complicated swaps in history, but they're home. Kamala and I are going to keep working. I mean, all Americans wrongfully detained around the world, home. I mean it. Folks, I've got 5 months left in my presidency. I've got a lot to do. I intend to get it done. You see, it's been the honor of my lifetime to serve as your president. I love the job, but I love my country more. I love my country more. And all this talk about how I'm angry at all those people who said I should step down, that's not true. I love my country more, and we need to preserve our democracy. In 2024, we need you to vote. We need you to keep the Senate. We need you to win back the House of Representatives. And above all, we need you to beat Donald Trump. And elect Kamala and Tim, President and Vice President of the United States of America.
As President Biden was speaking, a group of people unfurled a banner that said, "Stop arming Israel." The people behind them grabbed the banner as the crowd yelled, "We love Joe." Over 40,000 Palestinians have been killed, and many say this would not have been possible without U.S. support. Democracy Now!'s Amy Goodman interviewed one of the protesters, Liano Sharon, a DNC delegate from Michigan.
I did that because we are currently funding a genocide, and we need to, and it needs to stop. And also, I want to make it clear to the Harris campaign that this is actually in their interest. Netanyahu is trying to instigate a larger war so he could remain in power and avoid going to prison. In order to move Netanyahu off of his current position of trying to expand the war in order to stay in power and remain out of jail, we believe that the U.S. needs to stop arming Israel, needs to have an embargo against their genocide. Otherwise, Netanyahu doesn't have the incentive to stop the genocide, to stop the mass murder.
Why does this matter to you so much?
It matters to me so much because I'm a Jew, and I was always brought up to believe that never again means never again for anyone, anywhere, ever, period. And that's not what's happening right now. What's happening right now is that we are continuing to fund and support an ongoing genocide, the mass murder of children, and it needs to stop.
That was Democracy Now!'s Amy Goodman interviewing one of the protesters that unfurled a banner that said Stop Arming Israel, Liano Sharon, a DNC delegate from Michigan. Thanks to Democracy Now! For that clip. At yesterday's convention, we also heard harrowing abortion stories from three women. We heard union activists speaking out for the working class. We heard about disability rights and, of course, so many speakers. Joining us from the convention in Chicago are three guests. Will Bunch is a national columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer and author of After the Ivory Tower Falls, How College Broke the American Dream and Blew Up Our Politics and How to Fix It. Hi, Will. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Oh, yeah. Hey, Rose. Thanks for inviting me. I appreciate it.
Great to have you. India Walton is senior strategist with Roots Action, a community activist and a union nurse in Buffalo, New York. Hi, India. Thank you for taking the time and thanks for joining us again.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me.
Well, great to have both of you. So a lot has happened already on the first day. What has stood out for both of you so far? India, why don't we start with you?
Sure. And Hanya is here with me as well. We're just on the same line.
Okay, great. Let me introduce her. I wasn't sure if she was there. So we're happy to have Hanya Jodat join us. Hanya is a political strategist with Diffuse Nuclear War, a joint endeavor of Roots Action. She's a founding member of the Women's March Los Angeles and Assembly District Delegate from California. Hi, Hanya. Thank you so much. Sorry about that. I didn't know you were sharing a line with Hanya.
Hi, Rose. Pleasure to be here with you.
Thank you. Okay, so go ahead, India. What has stood out for you so far?
I don't think anything is standing out so much as it is exactly what I expected, which is Democrats doing what Democrats do, not addressing the issues and congratulating themselves on having made very incremental progress.
Do you expect more in the coming days, given that this is just day one?
I'm hoping for more. I am an eternal optimist, and I'm hoping that we're going to see some solid policy platform roll out. And I'm hoping that we'll see a bigger commitment to end the genocide in Gaza.
Hanya, what about you? What has stood out for you so far?
Thank you, Rose. I do have to echo my colleague here in saying that really this has been the usual crowd just celebrating, you know, their own accomplishments, really ignoring the cries of what the people in the streets are asking for. So for me, what has stood out the most is that, you know, while we're seeing the same old, vote blue no matter who, and again, some allies at the DNC, we're also seeing some protesters protesting our flawed foreign policies outside of the convention. And there is a sense of solidarity that I've never seen before from some of our allies who are against war, against militarism, the anti-war movement. But I also have to say, from someone's perspective who's not from this country, I'm Iranian American. It is very hard to belong to a party or feel like you belong to a party that doesn't necessarily humanize your region of the world or people from the region of the world that you belong to. So it's a mixed feeling, to be honest with you.
Will, you have a column out today in the Philadelphia Inquirer called Before the DNC Show, Democracy Broke Out on the Streets of Chicago. Outnumbered by cops and ignored by top Democrats, regular folks furious about Gaza aired their grievances in the Chicago streets. You were out there on the streets interviewing people. Tell us about some of those conversations and what stood out for you.
Yeah, you know, I feel, you know, I watch a lot of TV coverage, and if you watch these, you know, cable TV news shows like Morning Joe, I mean, these protesters are depicted kind of as cartoon characters, right? That that they must be motivated by anti-Semitism, and you know, they can't imagine why else these folks would be protesting. And of course they never have protesters on as guests, you know, or talk to any of them. And I really believe in listening to people, and you know, almost everybody. And I talked to a lot of people out there yesterday at Union Park, and then before they went off on the march. And the people are who they say they are. They're horrified by what's happening in Gaza. They are horrified that the United States continues to supply weapons to Israel despite the death of more than 40,000 people, many of them women and children. And they're very disappointed with the Democratic Party. And this really, I guess, echoes what your other guests have said. But, you know, they're disappointed with the Democratic Party not listening to them, especially, you know, when they actually ask people and take polls. The majority of rank and file Democrats don't want arms shipments to Israel. They oppose this. And yet it's kind of a taboo. It's kind of the issue that dare not speak its name inside the convention hall. And, I argue that this is the real democracy, because these people are exercising the rights in the Constitution, you know, free speech, the right of assembly, and, you know, as enunciated in the Constitution, the right to air their grievance with the government when the government is not listening to the people. And, you know, it's a shame that their activities are constricted to this narrow area. We've gotten kind of used to it, but it's almost shocking the massive size of the police response. You know, every inch of the march route was wheel to wheel with bicycle cops. There were hundreds, if not a few thousand of them out there. And, that's what the First Amendment's been constricted to in this country. So, inside the hall, they quickly approved a platform that didn't address, any of these issues about shipping arms to Israel. As your other guest mentioned, you know, or as you mentioned at the outset, these uncommitted delegates who unfurled a banner were quickly surrounded by people who, you know, with their signs, so that it wouldn't be seen on TV. And you know, where's the real democracy? Is it in the United Center, or is it out in the streets?
Will, you also spoke to people who traveled across the country in some cases to attend these protests. You wrote about a bus convoy that left Minneapolis and drove all night to the park. You also met a man who'd come from California by train. Some were protest veterans, like people from Code Pink, but others marched against the Vietnam War. Tell us more about the crowd and what they were talking about.
Well, it was very, very diverse. Well, that was kind of interesting, because I found a lot of these protests, you know, you see a lot of young people who are in their early 20s, and you see a lot of people, you know, boomers like myself, people even older than me, people in their 70s, who did protest the Vietnam War back in the late 60s, early 70s. I have to be honest, I'm not putting anybody down, but you don't really meet a lot of like Gen X kind of middle aged folks at these things, which is kind of weird. But basically, despite their diversity, you know, it's really where they come from on the issues all the same. I mean, they're pro peace. You know, they're horrified by war, and they're particularly horrified by this war, the way it's being waged largely against civilians. And they one thing that I heard over and over again is, they can't believe the amount of money that the United States spends, both on, you know, direct foreign aid to Israel, and also, you know, these arms deals that run through the military industrial complex. A lot of people mentioned this new $20 billion arms deal with Israel that lasts for the next 6 or 7 years, you know, meaning that we will be arming Israel for many years to come. And, you know, they wonder, well, why, you know, why is this money not going to our schools? Why is this money not going to, you know, social welfare programs that are underfunded? Why are our tax dollars going to fund this of all things, especially when the money, you know, when we see the images of the children who are being killed with the bombs that are being supplied under this program? You know, but there was a lot of unity in that group. You know, I guess I should also mention quickly, what I didn't hear. I didn't hear anything that struck me as anti-Semitic. You know, nobody was talking about Jews or the Jewish people. It was all about policy. It was all about the U.S. aid to Israel. And, you know, and some people would certainly like to roll back Israel's, you know, some people would like to return to the way things were before 1948. Personally, I'm not sure how that's feasible politically, but you know, they have strong positions about Zionism and about Israel. But I didn't get any kind of anti-Semitic vibe, and I was there for many, many hours. So
you write that several of the attendees told you they were Jewish, but that's the
yes, of course. Which, if you've ever been to these protests, is pretty common. A lot of Jewish people, you know, the values that, you know, like the clip that you played at the start of the show, people who were raised on the never again of the Holocaust feel that like what's happening now in Gaza is a never again situation. So it's not surprising that probably a disproportionate number of protesters are Jewish.
We should read, since so many people are talking about arms sales. This is a piece from the AP last week. The United States has approved $20 billion in arms sales to Israel, including scores of fighter jets and advanced air-to-air missiles, according to the State Department. Much of what is being sold to help Israel increase its military capability in the long term. The earliest systems being delivered under the contract are not expected until the 2026 timeframe. India, you have a lot of experience inside and outside of the political system. We should also mention that you talked last time you were on the show about what it was like in 2021 when you defeated incumbent Mayor Byron Brown in the Democratic primary for mayor of Buffalo, New York. The machine of the Democratic Party then got behind Byron Brown. He ran in as a write-in candidate and you lost in the general election. And you just talked about how you felt that the Democratic Party treated you and then really backed him. So you've got a lot of experience inside and outside of the party. What do you think, if anything, will change on this issue if Kamala Harris wins in November?
You know, I've been putting a lot of thought into this because there's a lot of nuance to it, and it's something that I am struggling with, taking a very firm stance against the continued arming and funding of the genocide in Gaza, but also being a Black woman and knowing that a second Trump presidency could be equally as devastating, you know? And I think that the difference between Harris presidency and the Trump presidency is that at least there is an opportunity for engagement. You know, things will be worse if the latter happens. However, Kamala has a responsibility, and it is an imperative that she has serious policy conversations with Palestinian leaders. It should be that's just basic diplomacy and small d democracy. And I think that these voices need to be not only heard but amplified. And one other thing that I would add is that Jewish Voice for Peace is on the front lines of organizing for peace in Palestine. So I think that this is a wildly populist movement. This is not some fringe progressive issue. The majority of Democrats want to see an end of arming Israel. And, you know, on our way into the convention, the sheer number of police that were present. Hanya and I are in the middle of writing an article about how the genocide in Gaza is not a single issue, right? They're calling us single issue voters. It's not that. It is so intersectional. It matters what they do in Palestine. They are doing to us at home. Our U.S. police forces have been trained by the IDF to respond for dissenting voices in this way, in a violent and aggressive and oppressive way. So we have to take all of these things into consideration when not only when we go to the ballot box, but as we look to hold the new administration accountable. And, you know, they're saying we have to protect the House and the Senate as well. And there are measures of accountability that have to happen at all levels of government in order for this to work.
And I just want to give some facts out there, India, in case some people raise their eyebrows and say, wait a minute, U.S. police are being trained by Israel. So I just want to mention a couple of headlines, and people can go find these articles. Amnesty International from 2016, where do many police departments train in Israel? The Guardian, 2023, another piece almost with the exact same headline. There's just a lot of news out there about this. The Intercept from last year, Memphis police chief trained with Israel security forces. There are a lot of articles online if you want to read more about that. What would you add, Hania? What do you think could possibly change with Kamala Harris? And an interesting question came up yesterday when we were talking about the climate crisis and what we could expect from a Harris administration. Someone asked a good question. You know, who is she surrounding herself with? Because that really tells you a lot in many cases. Do you have any idea who Kamala Harris is surrounding herself with on this specific issue?
I really would not be able to tell you who specifically she would surround herself with, but I do hope from the bottom of my heart that as a woman and as a woman of color, she starts recognizing that if she isolates the voices of women who are suffering from that region of the world, she is not going to get that far. And I think, you know, what is really important here is that the administration understand that what the people in the streets and what the people from Palestine and what the people from all over the world who are actually witnessing this genocide are asking for is very, very basic, is giving Palestinians the ability to live peacefully, to have dignity, and for the U.S. and its allies to stop erasing the Palestinian identity. And I think for far too long, this country has played the role of policing the world and wanting to change the democracies or democratic government to certain countries, while at the same time sending weapons overseas, bombing, whether it's Iraq, Afghanistan, whether it's now what's happening in Palestine, which is a catastrophe, right? We have to stop that. And I hope to God that Kamala Harris surrounds herself with organizers, grassroots organizers who've been involved in the anti-war movement, folks from JVP, folks from, you know, organizations that have been at the very forefront of this peace movement, and folks who don't lead with the pro-military ideology, people who lead with compassion, and people who have the guts to say, you know, we will work with other countries in the world to stop this military machine and bring that funding back home to resource our own communities. We continue to do this where we support sending bombs, billions of dollars to other countries to kill black and brown people. And this is not an isolated thing. We're talking about Congo. We're talking about Sudan. We're talking about, you know, the U.S. imperialism machine, right? Continuing to work overtime, to occupy, right? And erase identities and whitewash the stories, right? So we're hoping that that money that is sent out comes back to fund our resources that our impoverished communities are so desperately in need of, right? So I really, again, you know, hope that she surrounds herself with people who are compassionate, people from diverse communities, women of color who continue to deliver, the largest number of voting blocks in this country that are often forgotten, and people from the Palestinian community. We want to see diversity. And I just hope as a mother that, you know, for me, what's been really hard, Rose, and, you know, I don't even want to talk about policy for a moment. I want to talk about watching the images of children completely come out from under rubble who are missing limbs. And it is just so heart-shattering, right? Mm. And so I hope as a woman, she leads with a ton of compassion, because there's a lot of mothers who are mourning what's happening in Congo.
Yes, and a number of fathers. We've talked about this many times on the show, but because there's so much focus on the women and the children, which of course that is so important, I feel like the men have been, I guess, purposely left out, because in the media, they often tie Palestinian men to terrorism. And I've seen so many horrific videos of men who've lost their children or their entire family. And this one I just can't stop thinking about. I'm just reading now from NBC. This just happened. Newborn twins killed in Israel's offensive in Gaza as their dad went to get their birth certificates. And I'll just read this piece before we go to break. It was supposed to be a joyful affirmation of new life in Gaza's ruins. Instead, as Mohammed Abu El Komasan waited to collect the birth certificates of his days-old twins, he learned the newborns and his wife had been killed in what officials and witnesses said was an Israeli strike. He told NBC, "The pain inside me is too big for me to express. I still feel like I am in a nightmare." He was holding up the birth certificates of his kids, Aysel and Asser, with tears in his eyes. And I want to do a show about this in the coming weeks, but just the fact that we're all watching this happen in real time. I saw video of him in the hospital. So someone was taking that video, because international journalists are still not allowed to get in. Someone was taking that video, hoping that something would change. And we've seen this for the last 10 months. We're going to take a quick break, but if you'd all like to respond to that, we can do that right after a break. On today's Your Call, we are talking about day one of the Democratic National Convention. A number of speakers talked about Israel's ongoing assault on Gaza, whether talking about the children, talking about a ceasefire, talking about returning hostages. Something came up from a number of the speeches. But the question is, what does that mean in practice? We're also going to talk about other things we heard yesterday, including harrowing abortion stories from three women. Union activists spoke out for the working class. There was also some speeches about disability rights. If you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Will Bunch is national columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. India Walton is senior strategist with Roots Action, a community activist and union nurse in Buffalo, New York. Hanea Jodat is political strategist with Diffuse Nuclear War, a joint endeavor of Roots Action, and Assembly District Delegate from California. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. This week, we are doing a week-long series on the Democratic National Convention in Chicago. We will talk about what's happening inside and outside of the hall. We will also talk about specific policies. If you'd like to join us, what has stood out for you so far? What are you hoping to hear from the Democratic Party's top politicians? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Today, we're joined by three guests who have been kind enough to take some time from Chicago to join us. Will Bunch is a national columnist with the Philadelphia Inquirer. India Walton is senior strategist with Roots Action. In 2021, she defeated Democratic incumbent Mayor Byron Brown in the primary for mayor of Buffalo, New York. The Democratic machine then got behind Byron Brown. He ran as a write-in candidate, and India Walton lost in the general election. Hanea Jodat is political strategist with Diffuse Nuclear War, a joint endeavor of Roots Action, and Assembly District Delegate from California. Will, do you have any thoughts on what we brought up earlier about why so many people are so passionate about what is happening in Gaza? And I just have been thinking about this a lot. We did not have this level of social media and people with a phone in Afghanistan and Iraq. We just didn't have this kind of real-time video, these harrowing videos that we're seeing day after day.
Yeah, no, I think that's a huge part of it. You know, when you think about the way that certain things, the way the public reacted to certain things before social media and the iPhone era and after, I mean, another example, it's slightly different, but it's George Floyd, right? You know, I mean, unfortunately, police brutality has been with America throughout its history, but it's only been in the last 15 years or so that so many incidents of police brutality were captured on video. And when people saw what was done to George Floyd, you had literally millions. And when I say millions, I mean 20, 30 million people took part in one kind of Black Lives Matter march or another after George Floyd was killed. And so my point being that, you know, I think the situation in Gaza is very similar. I think it's compounded because I think Israel's strategy, if you can call it that, in Gaza is so focused on targeting civilian areas that, you're getting these videos almost every day. Even for all the horrors and war crimes and whatnot that were committed in Iraq or Afghanistan, it probably wasn't the level of daily, disturbing images that we're seeing out of Gaza. And you almost wonder why the protest movement isn't larger, because these images of, you know, children who, you know, either been crippled, maimed, I should say, or killed, and we see the images of their bodies, and it's just the most horrifying thing I've seen in my lifetime. And again, when you were asking me earlier about why people, might get on a train from California, or why people might take a 7-hour bus ride from Minneapolis, spend a day listening to speeches and marching, and then get right back on the bus and go 7 hours back home, it's because of these images and the emotions they stir up in people. It's like, there's a famous line in the song Ohio that Neil Young wrote after Kent State, where he says, how can you run when you know? And it's kind of like that, I think, with Gaza. It's like, when you see these images, these people feel, how can you not speak up? And again, it's a little surprising the protest movement isn't even larger because of that.
Hmm. Well, let's hear from a caller. Let's go to KC in San Francisco. Hi, KC. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Rose. I just want to make a comment where I watched the Democratic convention last night, and it was wonderful. I did. I really enjoyed it. You know, it's sort of like the Democratic Party is like Hollywood. Have a lot of stars, more stars, between Hollywood and the party than there are in the sky. So that was kind of like the highlight. But one of the things that really kind of sat with me is that we have never had the possibility of a woman in office. It's all been so male-oriented. It's sort of like that whole thing, men are from Mars and women are from Venus. And so this would kind of be the first time, that we've really had a possibility of a softer, kind of dynamic in the White House. And I'm just kind of thinking and wondering how different that will be, because we don't know that, because it's all been men.
Right.
And so with that, men, think a certain way, do a certain way. Women are different. They think they're more, kind of maternal and nurturing. So it's going to be very interesting. That's what I was thinking, to see how that's going to play out with her involved with these men of power, these men of supremacy, and what effect her being a woman will have on being able to maybe even quell the wretched warlike dynamic in men, and may have a better row of it being a woman as opposed to men, and how they, kind of like perform and deal with each other, because it's like, who's got the bigger guns, per se? Women come in the picture, it could be very different, And so that was one of my concerns. Will she be able, to have that kind of effect, where we may not, she might be better able? We don't know that yet until she gets it. And she might be better able to deal with this power play and this power play of supremacy that men have with each other. And it may have some effect on a better ceasefire or better engagement to quell war, per se.
Well, Casey, thank you so much. And this is the question we're all wondering. India, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think they may have jumped off the call. I have some thoughts about this, and I certainly share the caller's sentiment. I understand. I think the weird thing is that history, I think, has kind of shown the opposite, because I feel like the kind of woman who rises to a certain level in politics and wants to rise to the very highest level, they feel, because they are a woman, that they're not going to get to where they want to go unless they show their toughness. You know, I mean, I still remember, this is going back 20 years, but Hillary Clinton took a lot of criticism for her position, on the Iraq war and her votes on that. And, I think it was, that just might have been her inclination anyway, but I think a lot of people felt that, that she felt if she wanted to run for president someday, that she had to show that she was tough, that she was not afraid to use the military. The United States has never had a woman president, but if you look at other nations, that have had women leaders, whether it's, if you go all the way back to some of the very first ones like Golda Meir or Indira Gandhi or Margaret Thatcher, almost all of them were involved in military conflict. So it may be one of those hopes that the reality is a woman president. And I think this would be true for Kamala Harris. I think she'd be under a lot of pressure when she got into office to show that she's tough. I think Barack Obama, as the first African American president, felt some of those pressures too. So it's interesting. We'll see how it plays out. Hopefully, we'll see how it plays out next year.
Well, and we're going to do a show about foreign policy. Is how do you shift U.S. foreign policy? Given, well, I don't want to simplify it at all, but when you look at just how much money is spent on weapons, and this hardly gets talked about. Reuters had a piece in March about President Biden's $895 billion national security budget request. I was struck during his speech last night, Will, when he talked about taxes, about how Trump wants to cut taxes for the wealthy by even more than $2 trillion. Biden said, if we just increased billionaires' taxes, because right now we're paying less than billionaires. That deserves to get more attention too, but in taxes. So he said, if we increase taxes by about 25%, which is not even the highest tax rate, it would raise $500 billion over 10 years. And I thought to myself, okay, $500 billion over 10 years. And yet for 1 year, you're asking for an $895 billion military budget. How do you even begin to crack that?
Yeah, I mean, think about how easy it would almost certainly be to lope $50 billion a year, which is what we're talking about, out of that bloated budget. It's very frustrating. I'm somebody who grew up in the Vietnam and in the immediately post-Vietnam era. And, I had this naive hope that there would be a different attitude in the United States towards our military industrial complex. And we just have not seen it, for all the talk about how Congress is so divided and bickers about everything and can't get anything done. There's never any meaningful debate about this defense, budget. And, it keeps increasing. A lot of times they just keep in a few extra billion dollars at the end of the process for God knows what. And, we spend more than the next nine countries on the list on our military than all of them combined. So it's not like just we spend more on our military by a little bit than say China or Russia or anybody else. I mean, we spend way, way more on our military than any other country, and yet it's one of these untouchable subjects that we don't debate on. And, you know, we're not going to hear, you know, I can guarantee you between now and Thursday, we're not going to hear anything any radical proposals to change that out of the Democrat. And this is the more liberal party, supposedly, and we're not going to hear anything out of the Democrats about changing that. It's very frustrating. And I'm almost, you know, after a lifetime of seeing this play out, I've kind of thrown my hands up on thinking of wondering even how this could possibly be changed. You'd have to elect so many new members of Congress with a different attitude, which is just impossible. So it's not a good situation.
Yeah. And we should say that over about half of the military budget, so about $840 billion around there, it goes to weapons contractors. We did a show last June about this incredible 60 Minutes investigation. It found that weapons contractors like Lockheed Martin and Raytheon overcharged the Pentagon on almost everything the Department of Defense buys with taxpayer dollars every year. It was incredible to see that on 60 Minutes. The problem, Will, and this is a problem, I think, across the media, it just didn't get that much play. I was hoping it would get a lot more attention on the cable shows, and it just didn't. It kind of fell flat after it aired.
Yeah, it's a problem. It's definitely a problem in the media. I mean, the coverage has been terrible. It's also, I think, you know, the way the military-industrial complex works, you know, they've done an amazing job in spreading out these defense plants and these employers, and, you know, that with that much money being spent on defense, the defense industry is a large employer in so many districts. I mean, heck, if you go back to the 80s, there was even a situation where, you know, Bernie Sanders was on board with, you know, more money for helicopters because the helicopters were being made in Vermont, you know, in Burlington. So, even somebody who's as progressive on this issue as Bernie Sanders, if it's in his district, it's hard for him to vote against jobs. You know, that's the way this thing gets set up. And it's very hard to knock it out.
Well, today we're speaking about the Democratic National Convention. Day one was yesterday. It continues tonight. Will Bunch is national columnist with the Philadelphia Inquirer. And we just found out that our other two guests had to leave. So we want to thank India Walton and Hania Jodat. And thank you so much, Will. I know that you've got a lot of reporting to do, and it takes all day to do that. So thank you for sticking with us. We'll let you go in just about 8 minutes. Does that work for you?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, great. Thank you. If you have any questions or comments, what are your thoughts on the Democratic Party, what you are hearing from some of the highest officials in the party, what you want to hear, what message are they sending, where do you think the party is going? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. If you're listening on KALW, we will be live tomorrow night and Thursday night starting at 6 p.m. We'll be covering the convention. We'll be taking your calls and emails, so we hope you can tune in for that. I want to ask you about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. It's been so interesting watching her progression within the party. Remember when she first won her race, she joined climate protesters in Nancy Pelosi's office. And she had a major speaking slot last night. She spoke right before Hillary Clinton spoke. And I'm going to play her clip in a minute, but I wonder what your thoughts are. What does this tell you about the future of the Democratic Party, Will?
Yeah, you know, I had a lot of thoughts about that. After I got back from covering and then writing about the protest, I was able to watch her speech last night. And, you know, there was always this question about AOC in terms of, she had two directions she could go. One is she no doubt could have established herself, I think, as almost the undisputed leader, at least, or up and coming leader, you know, as we pass the torch from, you know, Bernie Sanders and some of the Elizabeth Warren and some of the other folks. You know, she could have become the undisputed leader of the far left, or she could do what so many people do when they go to Washington and try to be an insider, you know, and become somebody who has a chance of, you know, rising to top levels in like House leadership, or maybe run for the Senate from New York someday. And I think watching the speech last night, it's clear what path she's chosen. You know, she's chosen to be a loyal party soldier with the idea that by doing that, I think, you know, she hopes to move the Democratic Party somewhat leftward, you know, and it's awkward. I mean, she, you know, she finds herself caught in a position between, on the issue we've been talking about so much of the show, you know, on the Gaza Middle East question, you know, she finds herself torn between, you know, the protesters, a lot of whom were the people who, you know, got her into office in the first place, or those types of people, you know, or promoting the party line, which is, hey, we're working for a ceasefire and we're doing the best we can, which the protesters don't find to be an acceptable answer. And I mean, she basically gave the party line on Gaza, you know, that we're doing the best. Hey, we're doing the best we can. And we've got to get a ceasefire, but which is, you know, is probably what Kamala Harris is going to say. I mean, Biden's, you know, as you played at the very beginning of the show, Biden made a somewhat similar comment himself. So, I think that's the path that AOC has chosen. I mean, it could be good. I mean, if, you know, I think if, you know, if she became, you know, 20 years from now, if we have House Speaker AOC, you know, I think she'll be a lot more progressive than, say, a Nancy Pelosi was. But we'll see. It's interesting, the choices that she's made.
Right. Well, let's hear a clip. This is Representative Yes. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez speaking at the convention yesterday.
In Kamala Harris, we have a chance to elect a president who is for the middle class because she is from the middle class. She understands the urgency of rent checks and groceries and prescriptions. She is as committed to our reproductive and civil rights as she is to taking on corporate greed. And she is working tirelessly to secure a ceasefire in Gaza and bringing hostages home. In Kamala Harris, I see a leader who understands. I see a leader with a real commitment to a better future for working families. And Chicago, we have to help her win. Because we know that Donald Trump would sell this country for a dollar if it meant lining his own pockets and greasing the palms of his Wall Street friends. And I, for one, am tired of hearing about how a two-bit union buster thinks of himself as more of a patriot than the woman who fights every single day to lift working people out from under the boots of greed, trampling on our way of life.
That was Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez speaking at the Democratic Convention yesterday. She spoke right before Hillary Clinton, and we're talking today with the Philadelphia Inquirer's columnist, Will Bunch, about the convention so far. We got a couple of emails about this, Will. Marcy writes, AOC knows that collaboration is the key to accomplishing major undertakings. The approach of whining and criticizing is not useful. And then I also read a lot of tweets from protesters outside who said, well, what else is she doing to push for a ceasefire beyond what you said earlier, Will, is parroting the Democratic Party's talking points on a ceasefire?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the Democratic Party line, and this is what you heard from President Biden last night, is you know, we want there to be a ceasefire. He also said something about, you know, surging humanitarian aid into Gaza, which I thought that was kind of a joke, frankly. I mean, we've seen no surge from the United States of humanitarian aid into Gaza. I mean, we saw this pier that was only up for a couple months and didn't really work. And, you know, and we haven't seen anything, but, you know, and Biden said civilian casualties are horrible, and then he was quick to add on both sides. And I agree. I think the Hamas attack on October 7th was terrible. You know, I mean, today we found that some of the hostages, as expected, are deceased. And And I'm appalled by that. But you also have to have a sense of proportion. We're talking about, I believe less than 2,000 people, 1,500 people, which is a lot. It's a horrible, it's a 9/11 level loss of life. It's horrible, but it doesn't compare to, it just can't compare to 40,000 people, and especially a sustained bombing campaign in which, so many women and children and to your excellent point, innocent men as well, have been killed. When you say on both sides, you're creating an equivalency that probably isn't really there. So.
We don't have time for more callers, but Kevin again brought up the fact, is Kamala Harris going to bring down wasteful defense spending? And how is she going to change U.S. foreign policy? We don't know yet, but we're definitely going to do shows about that. So thank you for the call, Kevin. We've got a number of other emails. Most of them are on Israel and Gaza. Anna Marie sent another message saying simplistic analysis of gender differences is not useful. President Biden has demonstrated empathy at a significant level. Harris has been a prosecutor. Her approach will be revealed. Thank you again, Anna Marie. Yeah, we're all just wondering and where she's going to go. How is she going to be different from Biden? We have a couple emails also, Will, about money in politics. And I just did the math thanks to Open Secrets. Oh my gosh, $1 billion has already been raised. And that's just from Harris and Trump. 30 seconds, Will, you've been doing this for a while. Do you think we'll ever be able to get money out of politics?
I think it could be done. I don't know. Would it require a constitutional amendment to undo the Citizens United ruling? Because constitutional amendments are kind of impossible in this day and age. It's a shame, If you lived through the Watergate era, as I did, albeit as a teenager, but, people thought the problem had been solved after Watergate, and instead it's gotten multiple times worse. And, and it drives so much of what's terrible about our politics, including probably some of our Israel-Gaza policy. So I wish we could solve this. I really do.
Well, thank you so much, Will. I know you took time out of your reporting to join us, so thank you so much.
Oh, thanks, Rose. Thanks for having me. It was a great show.
Thank you. Will Bunch is a national columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer and author of After the Ivory Tower Falls. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.